to introduce the speaker. I was picking up people at the airport Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and every time I went to the airport, there was somebody from Colorado. But he was the one I went to pick up one time, and he was from Colorado, too. And of course, being from Seattle and not familiar with the freeways, I missed the exit we were supposed to take coming down 205, and, you know, end up on our way to Salem. But, you know, he was so engrossed with everybody in the car, you know, that nobody knew they were lost but me. But he got here, and we're here today. And so, here's Carlos from Colorado.
Hi, my name is Carlos, and I'm an addict. I got to tell you that I thought that was just your little way of reminding me the theme of this convention, the journey continues. It continues and continues. I thought maybe we landed at the wrong airport, and it was going to be a couple days' drive before we got to Portland. But it was okay because I heard the stories of most of the Grateful Dead concerts in the last 25 years on the way to the hotel, too. So it was a wonderful ride. I appreciate it. You know, sometimes I get a little bit jaded in these rooms, and I don't hear new things, and you know, it's like, you know, I've been here before. But I got to tell you, I heard something tonight that clicked for me. There's something that's always bothered me, you know, as I've tried to grow in recovery and learn in recovery, and that's, I don't remember what was said at the first few meetings I attended. Yeah, and I can remember people's lips moving, and I can remember hearing sounds, but I didn't understand any of it. And tonight I was reminded what happened. They were reading the literature in French and Hebrew. And in my first few NA meetings, what I heard made about as much sense to me as the literature in French and Hebrew. I'd like to say things have changed a whole lot, but most of the time now I'm so caught up in my stuff, you might as well be reading to me in French and Hebrew when you try to talk about recovery. I'd like to thank the committee for having me here. It's real special to be able to come and, you know, be at a world convention. This year has been a real busy one for me and my family. Unfortunately, it's not been as profitable as it has been busy. And we were going through our finances. My wife is working with me on that stuff now. And she explains to me, kind of like my sponsor explained the steps, my wife explains finances. And so we were talking about what we were going to be able to do this summer, earlier this year. And it didn't look like we were going to be able to come to the World Convention. Yeah, and it's kind of special for us because, see, 2 years ago, last week, I got married. For our honeymoon, we went to the World Convention in Anaheim. Yeah, and World Convention time is real special, and it was a disappointment to realize we weren't going to be able to make it this year. And so my wife sat me down, and we had this talk about finances, and she explained to me that 2 and 2 do not equal $867. But what we had was 4, and we didn't have enough to buy airplane tickets to come out here. So I had an opportunity to practice acceptance, and that was on a Saturday afternoon. The next day, I had an appointment with a guy I work with to do a fifth step. And I've been waiting for this guy to do a fifth step for about a year and a half now. And God moved this guy to do his fifth step. Actually, God didn't move this guy, I did. He was getting ready. He was getting ready to celebrate his second birthday. And I've been working on his inventory since well before his first birthday. I said, Marty, He came over one night and he was all excited. He was getting ready for his birthday party. I said, Marty, if you stand up and accept your 2-year tag before you've done your fifth step, I'm going to publicly humiliate you. And that year and a half process of inventory was done for him in 48 hours. So the day after I had my economics lesson and realized I wasn't going to be able to come to this convention, it was time for his fifth step. And we were visiting a little bit before he started, and I said, man, you know, the abundance of this program is just waiting for us. The gift has been offered to me since the day I walked in the doors. The problem has been I don't know how to accept it. And the way I learned how to do that is by following these directions. And miraculous things happen when we work the steps. And you're about to take your first fifth step, and that was a very significant milestone in my recovery. About that time the phone rings and we were interrupted, and I answered the phone, and it was Kitty, the woman from the program committee, inviting me to come to Portland and share with you folks this weekend and to be part of the World Convention. And just as I was about to tell her I'd love to, but I can't, she said, we'd like to buy you an airplane ticket and pay for your room, too. And I'm going, now, if $867 I don't have, but if I subtract $424 for airplane ticket, and if I subtract $192 from hotel rooms, I think I'd cover the rest with $4. So I was real excited. I hung up the phone and I said, man, they asked me to speak at the World Convention. And he looked at me with this real hurt look in his eye. He said, well, when you told me miraculous things would happen around my fifth step, I thought they would happen to me. But Marty's still clean. And I guess now it's time for me to talk about me a little bit. I suffer from the disease of addiction, and I've suffered from that disease as long as I can remember. And it's personally, and I guess that's all I can share is my experience and my belief, and if it's too strange, I'll just have to stand up for it because it's mine. I personally believe that I was born an addict. And my earliest recollections of how I thought and how I felt and how I acted, today I identify as the emotions and feelings and actions of an addict. So I don't subscribe to the theory that one day I did enough dope and it put me over the edge and I became an addict. I've always been one. I was just an addict looking for a place to happen. And some of my earliest recollections of being the right person in the wrong place at the right time is I can remember being about 6 years old, and my war story is a little bit different, man. I've never been a sailor. I've never been to war. I've been in jails and I've been in institutions. That was boring, and you've been there too, so I don't need to tell you about that. But I was 6 years old, and my family was at a picnic, and we were in this beautiful park and had a big water fountain, and my five-year-old sister was on her hands and knees on the edge of the water fountain, and was kind of precariously balanced, and something happened, and I saw her start to go head first into this water. And I reached out and grabbed, trying to prevent her from falling in the water, and what I got was the hem on her little dress she was wearing, and she proceeded to fall in the water, and I pulled her dress off trying to save her. So I'm standing, my father walks around the corner at that time. So what he sees is me standing there with my sister's dress in my hand, her half naked in the water crying and screaming, and comes over and proceeds to knock the hell out of me. How could I do something like that? And I'm thinking, what did I do? I was trying to do something right, and you know, it must have been wrong, because you don't get the hell knocked out of you if you're doing right. Yeah, and that's kind of how it went for me. I've been over exuberant all my life. I don't think I've done a whole lot that normal people don't do. I've just done a whole lot more of it. That set me apart. Yeah, and it's, I've never felt the ease of being at home. I've never felt the ease of belonging. I've never felt like I fit any place I'd ever been. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, and I grew up in Motown. And Little Stevie Wonder was the happening thing. We were like real close to the same age, and as I was growing up, he was growing up and becoming famous and all that. And I went to a school that was a couple of thousand kids big in elementary school. There was about 1,900 black kids there. There were about 98 white kids there. There were two Hispanics, me and my sister. We were different. We didn't look Hispanic, so even when we finally moved to a place that had a Hispanic community, even though with a name like Carlos Manuel Guerra, I don't look like I'm Hispanic. So I never quite fit in there either. That was difficult. And what I was left with was the only place that I could have any kind of association was my family. And as I introduced you to my father, his thing was he always came around the corner absolutely the worst time, saw things that really weren't the way they appeared, made his assumptions based on what he saw, and reacted accordingly. It wasn't real comfortable, and I didn't really fit there because I was always afraid. I was afraid of doing the wrong thing. I was afraid of saying the wrong thing. And that wasn't irrational fear, because I did the wrong things and I said the wrong things. So consequently, like most of us in here, I grew up without a home, without an emotional home. I first began to recognize that desolation and isolation. There was a kid in my neighborhood. He was a big sucker, man. He was a lot bigger than me. His name was Weeby. Weeby used to like steal my toys and my bikes and shit and my lunch money and stuff. He didn't dare me to do anything about it. And all I knew how to do about it was go home and cry. One day my father decided I had had enough of that. He said, "You're not coming home and crying anymore." So I went out and was doing my thing in the neighborhood, hanging out, and Weeby came by and stole my bike and my lunch money, and I think he took my shoes that day or something. And I came home crying, and my father met me at the door. He says, "You're not coming in the house." I said, "But Weeby's going to beat me up. I didn't have enough lunch money, and he wants more." He says, "Well, you've got two choices, Carlos. You can go out there and stand up to Weeby, or you can stand up to me." So I walked back out in the yard, and I'm looking at this big sucker with red hair, 4 or 5 years older than me, just with a maniacal gleam in his eye, waiting to do damage to my young body. I think he was one of us, too. I've looked for Weeby in meetings ever since then. So I looked at him. I took a couple of steps in that direction. I said, "Nah." I turned around and looked at my father. I said, "Nah." There I was in the middle. It was like no man's land. There wasn't any place to go. And there wasn't anybody to turn to. And that kind of my first recollection of the isolation of addiction. And the realization that, or what I thought was the realization, that I was in this on my own. And there wasn't nobody and there wasn't no place to go. And that's kind of how it went. And it didn't get better from there. It didn't get dramatically worse, but it didn't get better. So I grew up understanding the degradation of the disease And I grew up assuming that that degradation was mine and was a result of who I was. And it was my responsibility, and I couldn't do anything about it because no matter how hard I tried, that's how I felt. And one of the things I'm most grateful for in Narcotics Anonymous is being taught in these rooms that I'm not responsible for this disease I feel. I'm not responsible for this disease I suffer from. What I'm responsible for is what I do with it today. And that was good news because I had carried that responsibility all my life from the time I was, you know, kind of my earliest recollections. If there was something terribly wrong with me, I was had a mental deficiency. Because I always said the wrong things at the wrong time. I had a moral deficiency because I couldn't say the right things. I couldn't do the right things. No matter what I did, it was wrong. And and to learn that that wasn't my responsibility was the beginning of freedom that I never imagined was possible. Excuse me, I don't have a cold, that's a nervous cough. As I was growing up and turning into a young man, one thing that didn't happen was, regardless of how badly I felt, regardless of how badly life was going, I kept trying. Yeah, and I would do things like join organizations in school. One of my assets and one of the blessings I received was a large body that was fairly strong and healthy. So I tried athletic endeavors. At that time, I didn't have a real competitive spirit, though. That had been pretty much broken. I didn't have enough self-esteem to be successful at competitive kinds of things. But I had the raw tools, and it was another mystery why I couldn't do anything with it. And I can remember athletic coaches dragging me around by my face mask, yelling and screaming and asking me to develop this killer instinct that I just didn't have in me. And I guess I'm not proud to report, but it's kind of interesting to report today that through the disease of addiction and through the lifestyle I've led, I've developed that killer instinct today, and I think my high school football coach would be very proud of me today. For what I couldn't do when I was 16 and 17, I have no problem doing today. Someplace along the line, not someplace, I know exactly where, my first exposure to mood and mind-altering chemicals in an alternative life came at a camp out. I had joined the Boy Scouts of America. It was all my honor to do my duty and all of that stuff, and we went out to camp out, and one of the kids brought a six-pack of their favorite drug. It was kind of like the song, I tried it and I liked it a lot. And like I said earlier, normal people like it a little, I liked it a lot. Normal people used a little, I used a lot. And I was home. And that was the first time I ever remember feeling like I was home and it was just okay. I got violently ill. I felt like hell for a couple of days. But emotionally, that release and that just feeling okay was so wonderful and so attractive to me that I didn't care. I would pay whatever price I had to pay to feel like that again. And believe me, I paid a hell of a price for 25 years trying to feel that way again. I never found it. I chased that sucker all over the world. I take that back, not all over the world. I chased it as far as I could chase it. I spent every penny I could spend. I spent every ounce of energy I could expend. And I never found that feeling. But in my mind, it was always right around the corner. And all I had to do was try one more time and it would be there. maybe I do have an intellectual deficiency because I believed that for a lot of years. A lot of people I heard, like the guy was sharing tonight, maybe there was some truth to that movie about if you smoke reefer, you become a heroin addict. because one thing led to another, and I became the kind of addict that every mother has nightmares about. I became the kind of addict that the police department's eyes would light up about. And I did it until I couldn't do it anymore. And that's how I got here. I had a real problem because part of how I did things was I would do it till I couldn't do it anymore, and then I would find something else to do. And when I grew up and where I grew up, there were a lot of different chemicals that a person could try. And in my mind, the fact that I could use this chemical for 3 months, develop some unmanaged abilities and some powerlessness around it, and recognize them and being the right thinking kind of person I am, I said, man, this stuff is trouble. I'm going to switch now. And I switched to something else. And go until the unmanaged abilities would start again and say, man, this stuff is trouble. I'm going to switch again. So I went down the entire PDR. I went through every kind of illicit drug known to man. Yeah, and I did it the way, people showed me how to do it. But the fact that I kept changing and the fact that I could put down this chemical and move to another convinced me that I wasn't an addict. I couldn't be an addict. I quit too many goddamn drugs to be an addict. that concept of having just replaced them and continuing my addiction never entered my mind. I listened to what you had to say in these rooms for many, many days before it even began to dawn on me that what I was doing was just creating new manifestations of the disease of addiction. At some place along the line here, that feeling of when I'm loaded, things are okay. And when I'm loaded, I seem to fit. Yeah, and I don't know if it was so much that I fit, but I got so sloppy I didn't care anymore. But whatever it was, it eased some of that dis-ease of addiction for me. And someplace along the line, that stopped being effective, and it stopped working, and I couldn't find that ease anymore in using. And that was the end of active addiction for me. And I don't mean to sound like I'm talking around this, but we had a meeting the other night for speakers and people who were going to share at the convention, and they laid down rules for us. And you can say this and you can't say that, and whatever you do, don't use the F word. And they put me at a distinct disadvantage in trying to describe active addiction to you folks tonight. Because I realize becoming an acceptable, responsible, and productive member of society also involves learning how to communicate in a socially acceptable manner. But active addiction was not pretty and wasn't socially acceptable. I didn't read Emily Post when I was out there using, and my sponsor hasn't made me read the manners book since I got clean. Matter of fact, what he told me was, I came here to save my ass. I didn't come here to get polite. And that's kind of the way I practice my recovery today. But nonetheless, trying to be responsible for the committee that's treated me real well by inviting me here, I'm trying to describe active addiction in my life without using the words that best describe it. And personally, again, I like to share my personal feelings. I'm a little confused about that, and I think maybe that might be part of the problem in my home group. Should I talk about my home group because I'm a member there? Is that we've become awfully polite. And for me, fear and anger were progress in my recovery. There was a long time before I could make that step from terror and rage and understand and relate to plain old fear and anger. But that's kind of how it is. Without being able to use the words that really tell you what it was like, I'm going to move on to what happened then. One day I woke up and I tasted gun oil for the last time. and decided I had enough. And I didn't know of any other alternatives except ending it, or I was married at the time and had a wife who was involved in the therapeutic community, because she was one of those other things. I'm not supposed to say this word, but since I'm talking about someone else's experience, I can't. She was an alcoholic. And was involved in therapy and treatment and that kind of stuff. And which brings me to another point. I used to be an alcoholic addict. But we got a divorce, and I decided and swore to myself I'd never marry another one. So back in those days, I was out of options, and all I saw was my option, and the best I could come up with was 44 Magnum. There was someone else in my life that was making their attempts at trying the other option, which was recovery. And I played this game out until those were the only two options left. The dis-ease of addiction didn't get my attention until it was down to those two options. There was nothing else left for me. I have the utmost of respect for our young members and other members who come in and decide to get clean because it will improve their life. I didn't decide to get clean until it became clear to me it was the only way to save mine. And it didn't get my attention, and it didn't receive my full effort until it got to that point. And so when it got to that point, I was very fortunate I had insurance. There are places you can go when you reach that point and have insurance. And I went to one. And as things started to progress and I began to experience the therapeutic experience, there was a glimmer of hope. And it had been so long since there had been any hope in my life that I thought that was pretty neat. And I heard Bob sharing the other night about, his experience of getting into beef and wanting to leave. And as a matter of fact, when he was sharing, I turned to my wife afterwards and said, all I got to do is go buy his tape. And when it's my turn to share, I'm going to put it on and just stand up there and move my lips. Because that was my story. And if you're at that one, I'm sorry to bore you to tell you the same story again. But I had the exact same experience in the place you go when you have insurance. And I got into beef with someone, and I went to my room to pack, and as I was bolting through the door, they called that a code purple where I was. So when I was doing my code purple, people were running after me saying, "Carlos, Carlos, don't leave, don't leave." And I found that very touching. I said, "These people don't want me. They're chasing me just like Bob said, and it's because they don't want me to leave." And I thought that was very spiritual, and I thought that was a very loving and caring thing. It wasn't until much later I found out the reason they didn't want me to leave was I still had insurance. The Narcotics Anonymous didn't work for me until I ran out of insurance. So this is the place where we come when we run out of insurance. And it's funny how things change, my perspective of things change, but running out of insurance was the best thing that ever happened to me. Otherwise, I would have continued doing the kinds of things we do with religion, psychiatry, and those other alternatives. So I ended up in Narcotics Anonymous, and I wasn't real happy about it. And I ended up here after a little checking around, because what I was looking for was a home. I knew I had a problem. By this point, I knew enough that recovery was available to me. What I had to do was decide where I was going to get it. I've always been a real analytical person. So I set out about exploring my recovery options, kind of like I explored my using options, looked around and checked out what was available, and I came to a couple of Narcotics Anonymous meetings. You guys had this little skinny blue book, I went to some other meetings which had much larger books. And I said, well, you must get more for your money over there because they got much larger books. Yeah, so I proceeded to get my first sponsor. He was Gordon. I'm going to tell you about Gordon. The reason I picked Gordon for my sponsor was he had found a way not to use for 9 months. It had been 9 months since he had used. And not only that, to show you the quality of his recovery, he shared in every meeting that I ever went to with him that it had also been 9 months since he had vomited on himself and since he had defecated on himself. Yeah, to me, the guy was a god. I said, if he could tell me how to do that, he's got what I want. And I guess that's an indication of what I started at in this deal, because that definitely looked like up to me. And bless his soul, I'm sure Gordon still hasn't vomited and defecated on himself to this day. But after a year of hearing about, now I have 19 months and I haven't used and I haven't vomited and hadn't defecated on myself, and by then I had 12 of my own, hadn't used and defecated on myself, and I was still miserable, and I was still on a regular basis contemplating the taste of gun oil. And what happened was I could understand intellectually what I heard, and if I stretched and worked and tried, I could apply what I heard to me and relate what I heard to me. I walked into a meeting of Narcotics Anonymous, and what I had to stretch for and reach for, I walked in the door and it was like somebody hit me between the eyes with a 2x4. I'm not one that believes Narcotics Anonymous has the corner on the market of recovery. But they damn sure know how to put it in language someone like me can understand. And the reason I'm standing here today is there were people who could tell me what this was about in a manner that I didn't have to guess. I didn't have to wonder what was being said. After my first few meetings, it didn't sound like Hebrew and French anymore. It began sounding more and more like English. It started working. And I started looking at things more than just not using today, and more than just not vomiting and defecating on myself today. I had no problem with powerlessness and unmanageabilities. It was pointed out very clearly to me, and my experience proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that I was powerless. And the unmanageabilities that came along with it are still being cleaned up. And I have daily reminders today that that's what happens when you use. So I had no problems with the first step, no matter where they tried to give it to me. I had a major problem moving on from there because I wasn't quite sure that my problem was that I was just nuts. I was one of those people that was beyond any help. That while it was a neat trick I had learned not to use anymore, I was still loony as could be. And I saw no reason to believe that that was ever going to change. There was no evidence that that was ever going to change. Rather than just chill out and do what was being told to me, I became real frantic and real panicky in looking for the solutions and trying to find. By this time I had a sponsor that had many, many years of recovery, and I wanted to sit down and discuss theology with this man and talk about the God of my understanding. And he wouldn't do it. And after several months, what happened was he sat me down and said, look, there's two things you need to know about God, Carlos, in order for this thing to work for you. One, there is a God, and two, you ain't it. And if you can handle those two concepts, shut up, let me get some sleep, and we'll talk about the third step tomorrow. Tomorrow took about another 2 years in my case, because I continued at that time being an alcoholic addict. And And it took another 2 years before the alcoholic in this addict's life decided to book. Also, I've said earlier, I'm envious and very appreciative of younger members and members who come in here with, I'm not going to try and be polite, them high bottom addicts. I'm also envious of people who lost everything before they walk into the rooms. I was so screwed up, it took me 3.5 years to get to the of recovery or abstinence to get to the point of losing everything so I could begin the process of rebuilding my life. When I see people walking through the doors beaten, defeated, and having lost everything, I said, man, I think I must have 3 years clean. And that's what happened to me at 3 years clean. Life as I knew it was taken away from me. The relationship that I had grown to depend on, the job title that I had grown to depend on to prop myself up, because I still had no self-esteem, I still had no self-worth, and I still had no identity. The cars that I drove, the house that I lived in, everything was removed from my life. I had reservations, and I realized what it says in our literature about reservations and letting go of them. My experience was I wasn't able to let go of them. They were rudely removed. And they were taken away, and they weren't taken gently, and they weren't taken over a period of time. This happened to me in like 2 weeks. And that was a real experience at that point. And, I'd been clean for 3 years. I was sponsoring half the people in Denver at that time. I'm telling them how to work this program, and all of a sudden I woke up one day, I was unemployable, I couldn't have a relationship, I had no idea how to have a relationship, I had no place to live, I didn't have a car to go find a job, I was embarrassed to talk to my sponsor about it because I hadn't been talking to him about anything else, and now it became real clear that I had been bullshitting him about how things were too because I couldn't hide the truth anymore. And what happened was at 3 years clean, I sat down one day in my friend's backyard because I didn't have one anymore. And I looked up at the sky and said, God, if you're there, I'm here. And if you really care, and if there's anything to what they say in these meetings I've been going through for a while, now's the time. So I can't take it anymore. I've done the best I could, and obviously that wasn't good enough. And if you're there, help. And making that decision and asking without condition and without expectation that if there was a God, please do something for the suffering addict, because at that moment I was suffering just as much as I had ever suffered in active addiction. Something changed. And that's as close as I've ever come to having a burning bush experience. And I'm not, I guess I'm kind of pragmatic. I don't encourage people I work with in this program to look for burning bushes and wild, heavy-duty spiritual experiences. But that's one today I need not to minimize, because that was a dramatic turning point in my recovery. And that was a very dramatic point in that spiritual awakening. That was the beginning of my spiritual awakening. There was a crack of dawn, so to speak. At the time, I thought it was the whole thing. And what happened was life began to be bearable for me. I began to be a little more teachable. I made a commitment to do what comes next in recovery, because I made a deal with God, and by this time I had been around these rooms long enough that I knew that I didn't have anything else left. But one thing that had been given to me was some level of integrity in this program. If I gave my word, I would try and keep it. The promise I made to God that day is if he would let me sleep, and if he would give me any reason to feel like continue living, I would do whatever it takes to practice this program of recovery we have in Narcotics Anonymous. And I did that to the best of my ability, and I continue to do the work in this program from that day to this day. What's happened is the abundance of recovery has been heaped on me to the point of that now becomes the disease of addiction again, which is, I don't understand that, but I think that's part of why they tell us when we start coming to these meetings, we better get used to it because we'll be here a long time. As life has returned to me and as opportunities have returned to me, there's been a real fine line and one that I'm not at all good at identifying between. It's kind of like, at what point does self-esteem turn into ego? You know, I've never found anyone that can tell me where that is. And my routine is I get beat down till I'm nothing. And through this program, I begin to get a little glimmer of self-worth and value. In the blink of an eye, man, I'm, you know, back up here with the ego the size of Texas. And that's kind of how it goes for me. And my expectations were, I guess, that I would reach a point at, in recovery where I could say, I've done it. Thanks for the kickstart, you know, thanks for the memories. Now I'm going to move on in life, and I'll see you guys around. If I can ever do anything for you, give me a call, but not too late. It's not worked that way for me. It's been over and over and over again. And as the benefits and good things of recovery come to me today, it's not an excuse to cut down on meetings and cut back on the work. It's a warning that the shit's about to hit the fan again. Yeah, and I apologize for the profanity there. But I got to tell you guys something anyway. Like I said, it's really a disadvantage to tell you guys about my life in a polite manner. And at some point, we just have to decide whose goddamn story is it anyway. You know? Am I out of time yet? I'm not nervous anymore. So, you know, one of the things I've noticed in my recovery is my first inventory was real graphic. My first week, I was trying to talk about the progress and the ongoing nature of recovery for me today. The things that I identified in my first inventory, most of them were not in my next inventory. It was just as long, but it was just a whole bunch of new stuff. Where I'm at today is dealing with things like, because of Narcotics Anonymous, I have a life today. I have a life that's worth living. I have a life that's worth working for. I have a life that's worth paying the price for. And as a result of that, I have a tremendous amount of gratitude, and I feel a tremendous debt to the Fellowship of Narcotics Anonymous. There's only one problem. I have no idea how to express gratitude. I have no idea how to tell you guys how grateful I am to Narcotics Anonymous, how important it was to me to hear what I heard, the way I heard it, when I walked into these doors, without sounding like I'm telling you how bad something else is. And it's not a competition, but it's something I'm trying to learn how to do. Narcotics Anonymous has saved my life. No, it didn't. Narcotics Anonymous took that life away, but it's given me one worth saving today, and it's given me one worth being grateful for today. And I need to learn how to tell you that, and tell you that with some level of commitment and certainty, without getting embroiled in controversy. And I guess that's just like earlier we were talking about, at what level does self-esteem become ego? And that's where the stuff is at with me today, is how do I become part of the we? How do I accept the responsibility of being a recovery member in Narcotics Anonymous without alienating myself and everyone else? Because part of what I understand today is what was so freely given to me is not free. And if I want to get what I've been getting, and if I want to have the kind of life that Narcotics Anonymous has given me a glimpse of, there are certain things I have to do. And those things are not suggested. Well, I didn't need to know you to steal from you when I was out there using. And as I was making this journey through the steps the first couple of times, that was a real concern to me. When I was one of my early recollections about that is calling my sponsor and telling him, this ain't going to work, man. I've got to work for a living. I'm not a rich person. And to make amends, I'm going to have to take about 2 years off work and travel the entire United States. And I'm going to have to put ads in the newspapers because I don't remember anybody's names and where they lived and stuff. So I just could put ads in newspapers with rough dates when I was in town, and if you got ripped off by your car, just give me a call because I'm willing to make it right now. Now I don't know, I've heard about sponsors that are real serious and sponsors that are real dictatorial and say this is how it is. My sponsors have all been gigglers. I have these realizations and spiritual awakenings, and I've had several sponsors, and God lets me throw the old one away, but he gives me a new one just like him. And every one of them giggle. You know, I want to be taken seriously, you know, I want people to agree with me, and my sponsors laugh hysterically. So I was telling about this sabbatical I was going to have to take to make amends. And he introduced me to a real interesting concept. And I think he called it a living amend. Yeah, and he also introduced me to the concept of service. And he said, for many addicts, service may be an option. For you, Carlos, it's not. It's an absolute necessity. And if you want to keep getting what you've been getting, you're going to have to do more. And it was at that time. Because see, by this time, the wrongs that I had done and my inability to make amends for those wrongs had become a problem for me. Yeah, and become an obsession for me. Yeah, it very nearly reached the point of becoming compulsion for me. At that point, it was real important that I find some way to relieve that obsession and relieve that compulsion. And the way that happened for me was my initiation into service work in Narcotics Anonymous. I may never meet the little old lady that I ripped off for 6 months worth of rent when I first moved to Denver, Colorado. She's probably dead now. I don't know. But I'll never forget it either. And I had to learn how to make that right. You know, I don't remember whether it was a Texaco station or a Phillips gas station. I arrived in Roseport, Missouri on my way to cop dope in Ohio in 1974. But I'll never forget it. And the only way I can learn to live with that is by actively doing something that gives me the right to live with that. And that's service to Narcotics Anonymous, service to a suffering addict. we have a little, in our area and in our region, we're not real old and we're not real mature. It's kind of like the blind leading the blind. we have the best of intentions. And there must be a whole lot of other people that need to make amends like I do, because there's a bunch of us trying to do service. And it comes back to that you know, the acceptable, responsible, and productive member is I have to learn how to do that in Narcotics Anonymous before I can do that out there in the rest of the world. Yeah, and it's grace for me to be given the opportunity to learn how to do that in Narcotics Anonymous before I take that shit out the door too. So I get a practice on you guys. But what happens for me is I get a chance to, while I'm trying to save my ass and while I'm trying to clean up the wreckage of my past, I get a chance to learn how to be part of our society here. And what happens is I make many mistakes, and I'm involved in many mistakes, and I'm given an opportunity to clean those mistakes up on a regular basis in Narcotics Anonymous. And it's real neat to me how all of a sudden my life and my recovery begin to flow through all of this, because the steps in the beginning were real herky-jerky for me. And I'd have to think about one for about 4 or 5 months and make a plan of attack, and then I'd call my sponsor. He'd giggle for 4 or 5 months. And then he'd share his experience, and I'd make a new plan. You know, it'd take about a year to work a step, you know, get all this stuff done. But what's happened in recovery for me today is there's an order that's become clear to me, and there's a flow, and it feels like there's a flow in recovery, and there's a flow from one step to the next, and there's a flow. And, you know, one of the things that baffled me the most, and I decided I was going to have the most trouble with early in recovery, was practicing these principles in all my affairs. And today I'm happy to announce that that's not such a foreign concept. Yeah, I have some limited experience in doing that, and those are the days when I do a 10-step at the end of the day, and I can go to sleep with a satisfied mind. I've never been able to do that before. And again, you know, those are the kinds of reasons I have this level of gratitude and commitment to Narcotics Anonymous. And I got to tell you guys, you know, what I heard in the beginning, and one of the first things I can remember hearing, was that if you want what we have, you'll do what we did. And trying to step around and be polite and talk to people who are having trouble identifying themselves and having trouble deciding where it is they belong, today I have permission to say what I'm about to say. I went to this meeting the other night, and in this meeting were people that have a lot of recovery and whose recovery is respected because they were asked to share at the World Convention of Narcotics Anonymous. And what these people were told is it is not all right to introduce yourself as addict alcoholic. If you're going to share at our convention, you are introduced as an addict, and it is not all right to be an alcoholic addict. And if it is not all right for people that 15 years, 22 years, 32 years, 10 years, 8 years, whatever, I got to assume it's not all right for you. And it's not because someone sat up and made a decision one day. I'll explain to you why I feel that way, why I understand that today. Is I suffer from the dis-ease of addiction. I find my ease in recovery in Narcotics Anonymous, and I found it because someone explained it to me very clearly and very concisely in language I could understand. And my responsibility is to make that language and that message available to the addict who comes next in just as clear and just as concise a manner as it was presented to me. And for me, and this is just my experience, for me to identify myself any other way than I'm Carlos, I'm an addict, is a form of denial. I'm not sure which step it was, but I've learned someplace along the line my problem isn't dope. My problem isn't women. My problem isn't food. My problem isn't sex. My problem is the disease of addiction. And when I feel that disease, I'm willing to use dope, women, sex, food, whatever, to put some ease in my life. And that's the problem. there was a military man, I think it was in one of our original wars, and he must have been one of us, because the quote I remember from high school history is, "We have met the enemy, and they are us." Well, one of my favorite things, and I don't know if we're supposed to talk about that kind of stuff, but, you know, you go to convention and there's recovery knickknacks you can buy and stuff. I was at one time, there's this beautiful wooden frame in a burned inscription on the frame. I walked up and I looked, and there was a mirror. It had a nice wooden frame around it. I held the mirror up so I could read what was written over the top. It says, "You are looking at the problem." So I need to remember that, and my mind plays tricks on me, and the only way I can remember that is by working these steps. And the only way that I can work the steps and remember that is by hanging real close to your people. And the only way that I can be sure that I am fulfilling my part of the first tradition, I got to tell you about that too. It took me 3 years to realize the personal recovery they were talking about in that first tradition was mine. You know, I just kind of glanced over that and said, "Personal recovery depends on NA unity." I said, "Well, that must be somebody else's personal recovery, and NA unity is what you guys need to do. Because if you disagree with me, you're in self-will. And if you do what I want, we're unified, and your personal recovery is in order." Well, it took me several years to realize that personal recovery we talked about was mine. And it took me several years to realize that line in the text that none of us are capable of making consistently good decisions on our own applied to me. And all of a sudden, the importance of being a member of a home group, the importance of being a member of Narcotics Anonymous, and the importance of staying checked in and tuned in with you guys to find out where I'm at on a day-to-day basis took on new meaning and took on a new urgency. And I'm one of these people, as life's returned to me, I went from being an unemployable walk-in begging rights from my sponsor to today I have a job, today I own a business, today I have a couple of cars, today I have a new wife, so today I'm an addict. The more of those things that are heaped on my life, instead of becoming reasons why I got to cut back on meetings, they become more reasons why I need more meetings. I don't understand it, and it doesn't make sense to me, but the closer I stick to you guys, the more I'm capable of doing out there. And sometimes it gets so busy, I think, maybe I should cut back, maybe I should change my schedule. And to juggle the life that I'm leading today without the benefit of daily meetings is a terrifying concept to me. And I've seen what happens to my recovering brothers and sisters whose lives return to them. And when the schedule gets a little tight, what they do is cut out home group a couple nights a month or cut out this meeting or that meeting. And I can't afford to do that. All of a sudden, the steps begin to make sense. All of a sudden, once I stopped using dope and realized my next biggest problem in life was getting along with other people, the traditions got real damn important to me, too. You see, the steps of where I learned how to deal with Carlos and how to live in Carlos's skin, the traditions of where I've learned how to live with you guys, and where I've learned how to continue living with you guys and grow with you guys. And the opportunity to do that is exciting beyond words. I don't know how to describe that. And the gratitude I feel is beyond words, and the abundance of recovery is beyond description. If I try any longer to describe it to you, I'm just going to look stupider and stupider. So I think what I'd like to do at this time is say thank you, and once again express my gratitude to Martin and the committee for having me here and giving me this opportunity to share with you guys. I look forward to seeing you next time.